So I know at least in D.C., I've lived here for, I don't know, how long have you guys lived here?
Just 3 months.
Yeah.
Oh.
Since school started.
Oh, geez. So.
Hello, and welcome to the GW Wonkcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration at the George Washington University. We're so glad you've tuned in today. We have two lovely co-hosts on the pod today. We have Gabe Moss.
Hi.
And Kat Lundy.
Hello.
And I'll be your moderator, Jessica Blackband. We're going to begin with our Below the Fold segment. There's a lot of bold headlines in the news these days, and you may miss important policy developments that aren't as talked about in the media. So here we're going to take you below the fold and fill you in on some of the maybe lesser noticed but still important policy issues of the week. All right, so Kat, you want to kick us off with your Below the Fold?
Yeah, absolutely. So this story revolves around the Trump and U.S. Department of Justice intention to review affirmative action policy at colleges and universities. Specifically, a self-proclaimed Asian group feel that they're being hurt by affirmative action, that blacks and Hispanics and other races are receiving preferential treatment to fill race quotas. Mm-hmm. So a few things. I'm sure most of our listeners already know that affirmative action is an active effort by the government to improve the employment or educational opportunities of members of minority groups and women. And what's interesting about this article is that it's talking about Asian groups that feel that they're being hurt by affirmative action. Specifically, a group, and I say self-proclaimed Asian group because there's more to that later that I'll talk about, feels that Harvard University, for example, is discriminating against them with treatment or by selecting candidates that might be black or Hispanic over them, even though they tend to, on average, Asian Americans tend to, on average, have higher SAT scores and have higher GPA rates. The reason I take issue with this is that historically, Asians have been used as a model minority, and that term specifically applies to Asians as, hey, we have this race that isn't affected by what some people may see as institutional racism. So institutional racism doesn't exist because here's this one race that's been able to be successful. And I take issue with that only because Asia is the largest continent in the entire world and has the highest population. They have over 3 billion more people than the entire continent of Africa. And then within Asia, you have multiple nationalities and multiple ethnicities, and that success based on statistics show higher incomes and educational attainment for Asian Americans over other ethnic groups, but this doesn't subcategorize all these different Asian groups. So the article cites a couple of different poverty rates. According to U.S. Census data, Nepalese Americans have a poverty rate of 21%. Tongan Americans have a poverty rate of 23.2%. Whereas you have Indian Americans that only have a poverty rate of 7.1%, and Japanese Americans that have a poverty rate of 8%. What's interesting is when you have such a big group of minorities and then you lump them all together, the bigger groups of Chinese, Japanese, and Korean Americans tend to then just mutes all these other Asian communities that actually have way worse circumstances. And I was talking about the self-proclaimed group that's filing suit against Harvard. So the group that is filing suit against Harvard, the group at the center of this is called the Students for Fair Admissions. And if you go to their website, they're very vague, and they say Asian, that they're representing Asian students. But in order to see any of their literature, of course, you have to pay like the $10 membership fee, and I didn't feel like doing that, I'm sorry. But this guy, who is a conservative legal strategist called Edward Blum, is strongly associated with this group. The reason why I'm skeptical whether or not it's really a real group is because Edward Blum is one of the chief strategists in the Fisher v. University of Texas case in 2013-2016, where two white students were denied entry into the University of Texas and then sued them because they felt that they were denied admission because they were white. So I think it's just interesting how the policy of affirmative action, before it was conservatives using, you know, white people being denied admission, and now they're hiding behind a model minority to try and strike down this policy as well.
I find it interesting that they specifically call out Latino and African-American people when white women are the predominant recipients of affirmative action benefit.
Are they?
Yeah. If you look at any one group that benefits the most from affirmative action policy, it's white women, specifically. Which, you know, it is the largest constituency of any college-bound group, so that might be why.
Right.
But if you actually look at, like, how these policies impact student enrollment. So I think it's interesting what you're saying, right? They're targeting specific scapegoat minorities that were also targeted in the Texas lawsuit.
Mm.
Yes, exactly.
And I don't want to discredit the opinions of people that I've never met, and that, you know, I don't know anything about this organization beyond what you've told me, but just that dude being associated with it, I think you're onto something that says a lot about the, at least the legal side's mentality of this problem going forward.
And just as, and to our listeners, my dad is white, I am a mixed race, and my mom is half Filipino, half kind of like a couple of scatterings of other things. We don't know, my grandmother lies. Sorry, Grandma. But just being lumped into a group that's like, hey, we don't necessarily need to put funding or resources towards this minority and their advocacy because they're fine. Asian Americans, according to the census, are at 11.8% poverty rate. But if we go back to the Nepalese Americans who are at 21%, no, this entire group is not okay.
It's not a homogeneous group by any means. Yeah.
Exactly. And I'm sure the same would go, and I would love for our listeners to let me know in terms of, like, for African Americans or Black Americans, when we subcategorize by Americans from the Caribbean or Americans that are from, like, East Africa versus West Africa or South Africa, where all these differences are.
Mm-hmm.
In general, I mean, you can't, I don't know if the policies going forward should be like, hey, list every single country and let's make this more complicated, but I certainly don't like it being lumped in by continent, because even in some job applications, when they ask me, like, oh, are you Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, or Asian, technically there's no, and for people that are from, like, Turkey or Pakistan or Afghanistan, they also have to click, well, I don't know what they select, but I would assume they would select Asian.
Right.
So it's an interesting question, though, because ultimately their argument is this group is discriminated against and is not treated fairly and not recognized by federal policy, which is essentially the same thing as what you're saying, but you're saying it for different reasons, right?
Yes.
Their argument is they're not benefited by specific policy instruments that are designed to enfranchise African-Americans and Latinos primarily, which isn't in itself problem if they're not the target group of those policies. They're asking to become the target group of those policies, and you're saying, in part, maybe they should be, but maybe we should be more systematic or thoughtful about how we formulate policies going forward so that our policies actually address real needs of specific groups as opposed to needs based on monolithic understandings of groups, right? I mean, like, right.
I'll agree with the second part of what you said, that I don't like the idea of oversimplifying that Asian Americans are doing very well in this country by looking at their, you know, median incomes and poverty rates. But when you subcategorize by specific ethnicities, you see that there are huge discrepancy in income and poverty rates between Asian American groups. And I think it's unwise and inaccurate for conservative or Republican groups to present them as a model minority just based on these statistics, which lump all of these people together.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's smart on their part to do that.
I mean, it's frustrating because it's true in that Asian Americans are discriminated against systematically and intentionally and unintentionally, right? Like, that exists.
And
they're right about that.
Yeah.
They're absolutely right about that, that affirmative action should help to overcome systematic barriers to education for specific groups. It seems like what they're wrong to consider is that it's a zero-sum game, that because you're helping out more or equally disenfranchised groups, that you are not helping or directly hurting another group, which I think people just assume about affirmative action in general, which I think is a really non-holistic way to look at the issue, right? Like, if you're looking at just slots in colleges, that on its own, it is a zero-sum game. But if you're to consider the education of an individual from birth to death, then it is absolutely a much larger thing that we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And affirmative action is a small way of reversing some of the systematic disadvantage that minority groups face based on you know, income of parent groups or where they live, what funding goes to, the fact that almost every suburban area is segregated, almost every urban area is segregated, mm-hmm. and that the schools that feature in those areas are also de facto segregated. You know, it and actually, I should say de jure segregated as well, because it's intentional policy that has just not been reversed. Even though it's not currently law, it still has been law for so long that it effectively is.
And there's this, like, assumption that the proverbial pie is just always going to be the same size. And so why would we... Which is absolutely not the case. I mean, the mm-hmm. number of, like, you know, university attendance has, ballooned in the past 20 years. And so there's no reason to think that that won't continue, and it just will... The pie won't just grow more for everyone.
And then to add to the complexity of that in terms of the model minority, the minority that is proving that there's no institutional racism, you can't see air quotes, but that's what I'm doing right now, is that this doesn't take into account any, like, cultural racism they might run into. So, like, even though people may say that Asian Americans have, you know, higher incomes and, you know, are doing better off overall than other minority groups, there are still a lot of, like, underrepresentation in elected office,
right.
As well as Hollywood, mm-hmm. and then just the Hollywood stereotypes that go into being, like, an Asian woman tends to be over-sexualized or submissive and all these mm-hmm. other issues that go into it.
Yeah.
So for them to say they're a model minority because they have a lot more money, yeah, but we have all this other cultural stuff that we have to deal with as well.
Yeah. Yeah, Steven Yeun and a couple other prominent actors are... doing a lot of work on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Gabe, what do you have for your bullet points?
Equally dismal. So for the first time in the last 7 years, homelessness rates have increased in the United States. Mm-hmm. Now, to temper that a little bit, that's based on the yearly, or like the semi-annual count. So the Department of Housing and Urban Development counts homelessness in various ways. There's the point in time count, which happens in January of every year. It's the one cold night in January gets thrown around in news media, and you'll see that coming up in the next month. There's just like that poetic sense to it. But essentially, that's a count done at the local level of all shelters and all known areas of rough sleeping, so that it tries to capture as best as possible the amount of people living without adequate shelter, whether they're in some sort of sheltering institution or living on the street in some form. And it's just done through canvassing and just statistical appropriation or approximation. So that in itself is prone to error, prone to underestimate, obviously, and that will be coming out in the next couple weeks, probably the next couple months, I should say, from our recording session. But there is also a semi-annual count that's based on other statistical devices, other statistical tools, and that has shown that by the end of 2016, we've seen the first time that homelessness rates have increased in the last 7 years. They're still not at where they were in 2010, but they're significant. It's reached above 1% of the U.S.'s population.
Did they dissect this statistic by race or by veteran status?
Yeah, so here's where it gets real interesting. So though they do collect statistics on race and on veteran status, there is a significant over-focus on what is called the deserving poor groups. Mm. So that is women, children, and veterans. Despite the fact that they make up an absolute minority of homeless people, right? If you're talking about the groups that constitute the largest percentage, it's Black and Hispanic people. Of those, it's mostly men, it's mostly single men, right? A lot of them have histories of incarceration that are either predating or stemming from their periods of episodic homelessness, mm-hmm. and there is absolutely no discussion. I've like just finished writing a research report on this for Los Angeles, but there's no discussion by HUD or by smaller local housing authorities in most of the U.S. about that actually being a problem, despite the fact that both African Americans and Latinos are far overrepresented in the homeless pool. And I think it's pretty obvious why that would be, right? We're talking about systematic racism, we're talking mm-hmm. about underrepresentation. It makes sense why a group that systematically was barred from owning housing, was forced into higher rentership rates in high-density poverty areas, who is incarcerated at far higher levels than the white population, why those groups would find it harder and harder to acquire adequate shelter. Mm-hmm. But I think it's problematic because, like with your discussion of different subcategories of the Asian American monolith, if you don't address the barriers to housing faced by these different groups of homeless people, then you're really not going to create policy that's effective, right? Basically, we try to create policy that treats the homeless population as a monolith group,
yeah.
And most of that is aimed at families and veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And that will not serve people who have criminal records, because most voucher programs don't allow record holders to have a voucher. It will not help people who are systematically discriminated against in housing markets, right? Black people are shown far less homes on average than white people. They're shown homes in higher density poverty areas. They're not approved for loans at the same rates that white people are. And the Latino and Hispanic populations face that as well, though to a lesser extent than do the African American population. So basically, if we're not making policy that targets the barriers out of homelessness to the largest groups in homelessness, we're not going to see a reduction in any sizable portion. And although the highest increasing rate of homelessness is among women specifically,
mm-hmm.
that is still an absolute minority of the homeless population. It's just the largest growing number is women entering homelessness.
So what is the magnitude of the increase, and is there any speculation as to why that's happening now? Or at the end of 2016, right? Is that when this...
Yeah, so just under 554,000 people are considered homeless.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, so there's other stuff to consider with this homelessness figure. So we don't count people doubled up as homeless. Now, that can be just roommates, that can be two unwedded people living together who are in a committed relationship, but it can also be two families living in a single family unit. And that is a lot of the doubled up population. And if you look at areas like Los Angeles or New York, which are driving this increase, right? Most of the increase that has happened has been in Los Angeles, has
mm-hmm.
been in LA, has been in Seattle, Sacramento, DC.
Mm-hmm.
High density areas with a lot of homeless people already.
Mm-hmm.
These areas have notoriously low turnover rates for apartments, right? The rental vacancy rate in Los Angeles is somewhere around 2.7%. which is incredibly low.
Wow.
Now, this is also a place with 10.5 million people in the county, right? Half of those people are renters.
Mm-hmm.
Half of the adult population of renting age in Los Angeles is doubled up. So you have an intense density of people living in an area where half of them are renting, half of that population, so approximately 2.5 million are rent burdened. So more than 30% of their annual income on rent, and half of that, again, so 1.25 million or so, pay more than 50% of their rent. And the majority of people who pay more than 70% of their rent are Latino or Black. So you have beyond the actual approximately 50,000 homeless people living on the streets of Los Angeles, you have a housed population that is unable to adequately pay its rent month to month. So these are people who are in danger of becoming homeless and who would be the first in line to get apartments if LA were to grow its housing stock, which is something it's considering to fix this. There's, you know, not a direct cause and effect here for why this number has increased. Could be due to the opioid epidemic.
Oh.
That is a possibility, though, you know, that again is difficult to tease out cause and effect.
Yeah.
You know, are people becoming homeless because they're opioid addicts, or are they becoming opioid addicts because they're
homeless.
Plus, most of the homeless population isn't necessarily addicted to
yeah.
prescription painkillers, so there's that problem too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just hard to say, right? I mean, you're dealing with a population that is not adequately covered by the Census Bureau and thus cannot be adequately studied by normal conventional means of study. And so for Los Angeles, the plan going forward is to dedicate, I mean, they're asking for over $1 billion in housing infrastructure. They've gotten $85 million so far to build 10,000 units, but that's just 10,000 affordable units. That's a drop in the bucket compared to the, say, 1.25 million people who pay more than 50% of their income on rent,
mm-hmm.
right? New York is adding 15,000 homes, but again, in New York, that's nothing.
Yeah.
So these are not... You know, even if those 10,000 were to go to homeless people in Los Angeles, it's only a fifth of the population that's currently living on the street.
Yeah.
So there is a huge affordability crisis, and I think that's mostly what's driving it. And unfortunately, the department tasked with dealing with this population, with providing funding for housing authorities, for voucher programs, for new developments, is housing and urban development. And it has just gotten recommended a, 13% budget cut? Mm-hmm. So you have the first time in close to a decade that the rate of homelessness has increased, plus the one agency tasked with actually addressing that for the population at the federal level has just gotten a tenth of its budget removed. So, or potentially will get a tenth of its budget removed. And you have Ben Carson, the guy in charge of it, saying the issue is not the amount of funding, but it's about how the funding is being spent, which I think might be right. But unfortunately, what they're advocating for is help for the deserving poor, right? It's right. Family assistance, it's veterans assistance, which again is like totally a good thing on its own, but doesn't actually address the core issue, which is systematic racism in housing leading to high rates of homelessness among minority groups. You just don't have that, right? You don't have any sort of justice reform, any sort of housing reform for actual, like, requiring all landlords to accept vouchers. That's not, there's no requirement. Anyone can deny vouchers, and when the majority of voucher holders are people of color and women, basically you allow people to discriminate against minority groups, right? So,
yeah.
There's issues that are so large that I don't see it actually being addressed.
But there, so my bullet point is actually also about HUD.
Okay.
But slightly. So the housing voucher program, which is like what the HUD is really known for overseeing, which is known as Section 8, helps millions of basically poor households to pay their rent. And so if you obtain a voucher, then you only have to pay 30% of your income towards your rent, and the government will cover the rest at what's considered a fair market rent rate, right? The way this has traditionally been calculated is just taking this sort of mean rent in a place like New York City, which, as you know, some people are going to pay a lot more, some people are going to pay a lot less, depending on the zip code that you're in. So one of the things that the Obama administration did to try and fix this problem was he implemented something called the SAFMR rule, which would have come into effect on October 1st of this year, which required cities to calculate rents at the zip code rather than across like an entire city. And there was a lot of evidence in place that this would, I guess I didn't go into detail about why calculating at the city level isn't a very good idea. And that's largely because landlords can then jack up rent in areas that maybe don't generally cost as much to live in and essentially collect more money from the government, because any amount that's above 30% of someone's income, they're going to collect, right?
There's that aspect, but there's also just the issue of your voucher can only be used for an affordable rent.
Right.
And if the affordable rent is calculated at, say, 30% of the area median rent, then areas that have that actual affordable rent, like in Los Angeles, are going to be in Inglewood, South Central,
right.
Downtown,
right.
Because, like, you know, you got Santa Monica Hills, you got Toluca Lake, you got Hollywood Hills.
Los Feliz.
Yeah, you have all these, like, super high cost areas that are calculated into that area median. So you have a much higher rent. So it basically, like, it both allows private companies to exact a larger fee from the government.
Right.
And it forces voucher holders to either choose not to use their voucher if they find a place that's above that fair market rent value, or into areas of intense segregation, because it's only in those segregated neighborhoods where you find low enough rents to actually accommodate the voucher program.
So an article in The Economist this week discussed these kind of different benefits of calculating rents at this zip code level, and apparently there's some promising evidence that this would have really been effective. It would have helped people with vouchers to go and live in areas that had less poverty and generally less unemployment. And so there was some evidence that maybe this would work. Ben Carson has decided that it's not a good idea, so we're not going to implement it. And I don't know, that's really a shame, because that's just a kind of small change that would, in the end, probably decrease costs, even though, okay, it's a little bit more difficult and complicated to administrate, but at the end of the day, you're not just subsidizing landlords.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I just thought that was... And essentially, one of the reasons The Economist cites for him not wanting to implement this policy is because it was put in place by Obama, and so it's very, you know,
controversial.
Partisan.
Yeah.
It's just partisan.
Yeah, doing the localized area medians for a lot of stuff really makes a lot more sense than doing a whole metropolitan area median, right? Like for Los Angeles.
It's
in my head because my study, right? So the area median income is around $64,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
But in downtown Los Angeles, it's $15,000 per year.
Right.
So like you have an area median income that even 30% of it is above what someone is able to pay living in a specific area of that county.
Yeah.
There's other problems with the voucher program too. I don't know if you got into this at all, but like in California, the average wait time to get a voucher, if you're even allowed on the list, is 8 to 10 years.
Yep.
This year, Los Angeles County Housing Authority opened up its voucher programs for the
after
first time.
13 years.
For 13 years, and only allowed on 20,000 voucher applicants. Not even people who would receive vouchers.
How many people ended up receiving or going to receive vouchers from
I am not sure. I mean, it'll depend on up to 20,000, right? But it'll depend on their applications. But your application can get thrown out for saying having been arrested at one point in your life, having a family member that lives with you be arrested. Any number of things can cause you to lose your housing voucher. And in Los Angeles, it's incredibly hard to actually use a housing voucher because either places don't take them or the only place to use them is a place you don't want to live.
Right.
And just to apply this back to like how, I mean, just it sounds dumb to say, but how important location and housing is.
Mm-hmm.
Say, like, I know that anybody that works at the Payless Shoes that's over there on the corner of what I think it's like 12th and F Street, they are not living in D.C. If that is like their one, even if they had like two other jobs at minimum wage for these places, and they had to use one of these vouchers, they're living so much further away from the places that they actually work. I think if you were to do it based on zip code or based by like little localities instead of on larger metropolitan areas, then maybe the people that actually work in those areas could be able to afford to also live in those areas.
Oh, for sure. And DC is really interesting just given the absolutely recent gentrification and revitalization, to use the hated word.
A really good Washingtonian article that will make you super angry if you
don't
read it.
I should check that out. But you have the surrounding counties in the DMV are some of the wealthiest counties on the Eastern Seaboard,
mm-hmm.
but people living in Wards 7 and 8 have some of the highest poverty rates on the Eastern Seaboard. And the programs that are designed to help those people are unable to do so because the rents established at fair market include the surrounding DMV. Not the actual reality of Ward 7 and 8 and the rest of the wards in D.C.
So it seems like all of these below the folds have served as examples of why we shouldn't treat groups that are very diverse as homogeneous, and that it may seem efficient on its face to do that, but it has huge long-term costs and often leads to just total inefficacy.
When you treat diverse groups like a monolith, it's the groups with the least amount of structural impediments that get served.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
so
a really good.
It's if you're talking about homeless people, it's white people that get served the most by the programs aimed at homeless people, even though they make up the smallest proportional representation of their ethnicity in the larger population.
Yeah.
I mean, not to throw out the I word, but like the intersectionality of these groups is super important.
It's super
important.
You can't talk about housing without criminal justice.
Absolutely.
Like that's so tied. You can't talk about it without segregation, and then that comes into structural racism.
Or
and
you
education.
Can't talk about like women's equality without talking about black single mother women's equality as being like a whole separate issue.
Also, everyone, like The Color of Law, should be required reading for every citizen of the United States.
I just
listeners,
finished reading that.
You should read that book.
Read that book.
We'll post a link to Amazon where you can just click and go.
It'll change the way you
Richard
you see
Rothstein.
Everything.
Richard Rothstein,
a wise and kind man.
Yes.
Good God, that book is so good.
So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up our Below the Fold, and we're trying something a little different on the pod this week. One of our co-hosts, Kat Lundy, will be doing a one-on-one interview with Melissa Emery Aris. She is working at the GAO as the Director of Education, Workforce, and Income Security, and she's going to talk with us about issues in Native American education, particularly the involvement of federal government and the Department of Interior in implementing education programs in Native American communities. Thank you for listening to GW Wantcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. Your co-hosts today were Gabe Moss and Kat Lundy. Your moderator was Jessica Blackband. For more wonkiness, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is at GWWonkcast. And you can send us love letters and hate mail by emailing us at wonkcast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio as well as iTunes, and we're working hard on getting Google Play support for all you Android folks out there. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher and edited by Eli Richman, with music by Pelly Gunther. Thanks for listening.